It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Don Gagne has reported from Detroit to inside the Beltway to across the country and around the world since he joined NPR in 1986. 33 years later, he's the national political correspondent for NPR. He sat down with the Confluence's Megan Harris on a recent visit to Pittsburgh.
Don, we hear you all the time on our airwaves, but it's great to have you in person. Welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. And I love this town, so it's good to be here.
So glad to have you. Our longtime listeners might know that you got your start in Detroit covering the auto industry and big labor. What was that experience like as a new Cub reporter?
So Detroit is the place where I kind of learned how to be a reporter. I was not a journalism major in college. I went to Michigan State. I have a degree in advertising, of all things, and I parlayed that advertising degree into a public radio news job.
Those things usually go the other way around.
They usually go the other way, and I'm glad it didn't work out the way I had planned way back when. But Detroit was a fascinating news town to cover and remains so. But I was so lucky to be covering the auto industry because being a person of very varied interests in that industry, I had a business story to cover. I had an environmental story. I had a pop culture story. I had a fashion story to cover. I had all of this stuff, and I had the labor story. And once you get into the labor story, you're just automatically talking politics. And I think it was my coverage of the UAW and the Teamsters and other unions in and around Detroit that got me pulled into the political beat. And I'm still covering those folks today.
What did you learn maybe from those early days traipsing through union halls and walking into picket lines that helps you in covering campaigns and politics today?
So the thing I love best about covering the auto industry was getting to know workers. And that meant getting to know them where they lived, right? And in Detroit, it was in all that ring of blue-collar suburbs around the city, and it was the dynamic within the city itself at some of the big auto plants, unfortunately, many of which have since, you know, gone away. Mm-hmm. But what I learned covering unions, and I still apply it literally every single day today on this beat, is that there's no substitute for sitting down with a real person who's got, you know, real problems maybe in their life or real things that they're grappling with, and just talking to them. And then you know, in those days, it was kind of, how does this relate to the work you do? How does it relate to the kind of decisions you're able to make for your kids or where you live or this or that? And now I relate it to how does that translate into your support for candidate X, Y, or Z? But it always comes down to getting somebody to let you sit down across from them and making sure they know that they can trust you with their story.
When you started at a member station in Detroit, you weren't just dispatched there for NPR. How now, you know, on this national political platform, do you find those people where they are?
I do it the same way I used to do it. And that is, I mean, often it's, you just walk up to them.
Is it harder?
It's never been easy. It has never been easy. The hardest thing to do, and I'm always trying to make sure my editors appreciate this, is to approach somebody who's not a politician or not some kind of PR person or someone who is, you know, a captain of industry or whatever. I mean, I dealt with those folks when I covered the auto industry, but just somebody who woke up that day and was going out there, going about their business, and they didn't know a reporter was going to walk up to them.
So since you jumped into politics, what do you make of our current political situation? You know, a lot of people treat President Trump as a bit of an aberration, but from your vantage point, is he at all similar to his predecessors?
He's very different from his predecessors. Mm-hmm. He just is. He would, I guess, be the first one to tell us that.
For our listeners, you started covering the White House in 2001 under the Bush administration.
That's right. And 8 years is probably long enough to cover the White House and to be on that kind of a grueling schedule where the president's schedule is kind of your schedule and where he goes, you go, and all that. But I impressed upon my editors as President Obama was about to take over that I wanted to stick around for at least a couple of years. Some of it was that I'd covered the Obama campaign and I was well-sourced and I wanted to kind of make that transition to the White House. And I also wanted to cover the historic nature of that presidency with him being the first African-American president. But as much as anything, I wanted to see what it was like to cover a different president. Didn't matter who it was. And the thing that struck me was the differences between the Obama presidency and the Bush presidency were pretty negligible. Again, that's not a, I'm not talking policy here.
Of course.
It's important to make that point. But just in terms of the day-to-day routine for a reporter, you're trying to develop sources. You're trying to find people who are, you know, up in the West Wing who will talk to you. If they are talking to you, they're trying to spin you in a certain way, or they're trying to keep you from learning things that they don't want you to learn, either because it would look bad or they're not ready to release it or whatever their motivation is. But that kind of push-pull, you know, dynamic was the same. Now,
Does that compare?
Okay, so I need to give you the disclaimer here that I have not been at the Trump White House full time. I've been on Air Force One with him, and I've traveled within that bubble. But just from my limited experience, it's just a very, very different place for reporters.
How so?
There's no daily briefing anymore. For starters, Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, has just basically stopped holding that regular give and take with reporters. You know, and that was always a chance every day that you could count on where you knew you would get the White House take from the press secretary on whatever the news of the day was. But you could also start doing some planning and asking some questions about things coming down the pike. And it was just a daily conversation. That's gone. It's just gone. And that was a big part of your day every day. The way the president uses Twitter alters the beast.
It changes the immediacy of the office quite a bit.
It absolutely does. And it's not that the Obama White House didn't use Twitter and they didn't, you know, they were putting out photo releases of things the president did. But this president has taken it kind of over the heads of the reporters in the building there in ways that no other president has. Now, it would be different somewhat, no matter who was there. But I think it's fair to say that it is different by many degrees because of him and the way he does it. And then one other thing that's a little bit unexpected is he doesn't really do press conferences, and his interviews are more likely with friendly media outlets, you know, either with Fox or, you know, Sean Hannity or someone like that. But I flew on Air Force One more than 100 times over those years with Bush and Obama. You would stand under the wing, you would watch them board, they would wave, you'd be on the plane, they'd be on the plane, but you would never get a chance to talk to them. Like maybe twice or three times in 10 years. And Trump, President Trump, will come over and do a scrum with reporters right under the wing. And then you get on the plane, and 15 minutes after he just spent 10, 15 minutes with you under the wing, he appears in the press cabin. And he's doing another 15 minutes. He wants to advocate for himself at every turn and sometimes multiple times in the same hour. So that's different. And that's different in ways that people might not have quite expected.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, joined in studio by NPR's Don Gagne. Don, you're with me now because Vice President Joe Biden declared his candidacy for president late last week. You're headed back to Pittsburgh next week for an event with WESA and Point Park University. But these two trips may be the first of many for you over the course of the 2020 campaign?
I think it's fair to say it will be the course of many trips to this part of the world for me. I'm hoping at least one of them lines up with a chance to go to the ballpark.
So you'll be rooting for the Pirates then when you come to town, right?
Yes, as long as they're not wearing the guys with the D on their hat, you know? I have always found myself in this part of the world with some degree of regularity, especially covering, you know, working class voters. I mean, it's not just that Pennsylvania is a battleground state. It is. It's kind of the battleground state. And we all know how close it was in 2016. And there's no reason to think it won't be that close again in 2020. So that alone will bring me back here. But I suspect once we get to the general election, it's going to be Wisconsin, it's going to be Michigan, and it's going to be all over the great state of Pennsylvania or the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Correct.
It's,
there
yes.
we go.
So,
as you look ahead to 2020 and, you know, back at your career, how would you say campaigning has changed since you jumped into politics or even from your Detroit days?
It feels like everything happened in slow motion. You had that luxury of finding something out and knowing that you could maybe think about it a little bit. Not that we don't think about what we're doing. We do. But you knew you had some time before it was just flash everywhere and everybody had it. You know, I mean, you used to have a conversation with a source while you're riding on a campaign bus, and you'd hang up and you'd kind of look around at the other reporters on the bus and try to read their body language to see if you thought anybody else had it, you know, and it's very different now. Now stuff is just like out there constantly, and it feels like it's coming out of the fire hose because of social media and everything else. And then the campaigns are just playing by different rules as well in terms of how they get their message out, in terms of what kind of voters they're looking for and the kind of micro-targeting they're able to do and the kinds of ways that they organize grassroots supporters. It's also very different. You know, broadly, we still, we watched Joe Biden launching his campaign, and we see that he's courting the union vote by coming to Pennsylvania and coming to the Pittsburgh area. So you still look for those kind of big moving parts, and it's not that they're not important, but they're not the big blockbuster thing that they once were, given all of this other kind of smaller bore stuff that's happening constantly.
So far, we've got 20, that's 2-0, Democratic candidates in the race. Do you have any predictions so far for this 2020 campaign cycle, at least what we know about it so far?
No, I don't. It's an emphatic no.
Did you ever think you'd be facing 20 Democratic candidates, you know, 2 years out from an election?
No, I remember covering an early presidential campaign when I was still in Detroit, and there was one of those candidate forums in Detroit. I believe it was an AFL-CIO event. Mm-hmm. And I think there were 7 or 8 Democrats on stage, you know, and it was people like Richard Gebhardt and Tom Harkin, I think, was up there. And I remember talking to Richard Trumka, who was then with the mine workers and is now the president of the AFL-CIO, and just kind of shaking my head saying, there's 7 candidates on stage. Is that crazy or what? And now here we are with 20. Now the candidate field is, especially on the Democratic side, certainly this year is more diverse, and you've got gender diversity and you've got racial diversity. And we didn't have a whole lot of that 30 years ago. But just the notion that there are so many candidates, and I think back then you ran if you could really kind of see a path. It might take lightning to strike, but it's like, if all of these things happen, maybe I've got a shot. And I think these days we see people running because it's a good chance to kind of get well known and to get their brand out there. And I'm not going to start parsing the field to say who's where, but running and losing is not the kind of thing that kills your career. We have people with TV shows and book deals and national radio shows and everything else who ran the last 2 times. And it's been a pretty good career move for some of them, even though they were never going to win. They were never going to emerge from that field. So it is just an entirely different landscape now. Yeah.
Talking about trying to cover that immediacy, you know, as a correspondent for NPR, do you feel compelled to kind of wade into that competitiveness that reporters so often feel trying to be first or trying to be fast?
You want to be first and you want to be fast, but you sure don't want to be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And that's obviously the most important thing, and that's the most important thing at NPR. You know, if you could see the emails that fly around, you know, within the building and within our desk when something's kind of percolating out there, and we need to make sure we get our two sources on it. We're not just going to go with it because somebody else has said it somewhere. So you're aware of the hyper competitiveness in that regard. But the other thing that NPR still does, I think, better than just about anybody else on broadcast, certainly, is to provide context and analysis and to let a story breathe a little bit and to take you places where you didn't expect to go. So I think that's as important as anything else still.
Do you still love it?
Yes, I can honestly say that. I still wake up in the morning kind of jazzed by what I'm going to be chasing that day, and sometimes still like nervous about if I'm going to get what I need, if I'm going to find the people to talk to me that I need to talk to me, if I'm going to find somebody in that diner or in that union hall who's going to like crystallize this whole story for me. It's that hunt of a story that is still really exciting. And I think it's also healthy to kind of have that little pit in your stomach about it sometimes when you're chasing it. And I still get that. If that goes away, then I'll have to kind of have a talk with myself. But it's absolutely still there. Yeah.
Don Gagne is a national political correspondent for NPR and will be featured at the Media Innovators Speaker Series May 9th at Point Park University. Don, thanks so much for being here and for making time for The Confluence.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Joy Division formed in 1976, inspired by the punk scene in their native England, though their music would transcend that style and inspire countless bands in their wake. On this day in 1980, Joy Division played what would be their final concert. Their singer Ian Curtis would take his own life just 2 weeks later, on the eve of the band's first North American tour. He suffered from depression and epilepsy for most of his life. He was only 23. The show featured the group's only performance of Ceremony, a song that would eventually be released by New Order, the band formed by surviving members of Joy Division. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
Did you know that 40 years ago, the U.S. government tried to take on climate change and almost enacted carbon limits that would have radically altered the state of our planet? This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier. As you probably know, this path was never taken. An account of that history is in the new book, Losing Earth, by Nathaniel Rich. Rich is a writer at large for the New York Times Magazine, and I spoke with him on the latest episode of our podcast, Trump on Earth. I asked Rich why he wanted to write about this story now.
On one hand, it's the story of this deeply frustrating failure. On the other hand, it's the story of how a ragtag group of activists, bureaucrats within the federal government, and scientists rallied together and over the course of a decade were able, through determination and perseverance and a great personal risk, to bring in an issue that up to then had been entirely in the domain of the sort of scientific literature, and bring us as close as we've gotten to serious global climate policy.
I wanted you to talk a little bit about the two protagonists for the book, Rafe Pomerantz, who's an environmental lobbyist, and the former NASA scientist James Hansen.
Yeah, they're sort of an unlikely pair of heroes. James Hansen's work I was familiar with. He became the face of climate science by the end of the decade of the 80s. He spoke up before Congress and said global warming is here now and it's time to act. And Pomerantz is just a charismatic, fascinating, smart, indefatigable guy who, when he was in his early 30s, sitting in the offices of Friends of the Earth, the environmental organization where he was a lobbyist at the time, in 1979, he came across the problem of global warming while reading an obscure government report from the EPA about coal. And he started to ask questions. He started to say, well, what is this existential crisis? And he soon realized that it was up to him to try to bring this to the attention of the American public. And so he goes around D.C. with a scientist, Gordon MacDonald, who is also very concerned about it and who is also extremely powerful within the government. He's essentially the chief scientist for the CIA. They go around meeting with people at EPA, State Department, Energy Department, which, by the way, has its own CO2 office already by that point, and ultimately to the president's science advisor, Frank Press, laying out the problem, giving him basically a two-hour lecture on the history of climate change and what's going to happen next. And they figure that this will be enough, and it isn't.
What lessons can we take from this attempt to face climate change? And what do you think your protagonists would do differently?
Where we have had major change on major social issues in our history, I think one uniting factor is that the rational appeal is joined by a much more urgent moral appeal. And that wasn't really present during that time. And it really hasn't been present, at least in a major way in the public conversation, really until the last few months. The leaders of this new movement for climate action, they're no longer saying the science is real, we need to act. I mean, of course, they're saying that too, but they're also saying your inaction is robbing our future away from us. You are killing us, and failure to act is wrong. And that's a different kind of argument, and I think it's ultimately a more powerful argument than simply we're stupid not to act.
Nathaniel Rich is the author of Losing Earth. You can hear more of our conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Reed Frazier.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An estimated 40,000 people will participate in various events surrounding the 2019 Pittsburgh Marathon. During this week, we're exploring the stories of some of the runners. Nicole Holderfield is a 36-year-old, full-time working mom of two daughters. She's from North Huntington. She's running in the half marathon this Sunday. Nicole, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
All right. When did your fitness journey begin?
Sure. My fitness journey began in early 2016, actually. I actually set out to lose a significant amount of weight. Earlier that November, I was sitting at Kennywood Amusement Park for their holiday lights, and I was watching my husband take my then one-year-old little girl on the Kiddyland rides. And being the size that I was and a former worker at Kennywood, actually, I knew that there was a chance that I could not fit on those rides.
And May I ask how much weight you have lost?
I have lost 125 pounds since
Wow.
that time.
Mm-hmm.
So it was then that I made the decision that I needed to lose weight to be there for my daughters.
That day at Kennywood.
Mm-hmm.
If someone had told you then that few years later you'd be running a half marathon, you would have said,
no.
What?
No. I never enjoyed running. You know, I can make every excuse. I had athletic-induced asthma. I would get shin splints. I never ran the mile in gym class when I was in high school. I wasn't a runner. I was a swimmer in school, but physical activity just wasn't my thing, to be honest, at that point.
What was your goal? Obviously, to lose weight, but was it to inspire your daughter and now daughters? Was it just to be in better health, to be there for them? What?
I wanted to be the mom that they deserved. They did not deserve a mom to be sitting on the sidelines. I wouldn't get into pictures with them because I didn't like the way I looked. I wonder if my neighbors even knew who I was because I was not outside with them playing. And I was missing out on very key points in their life and being involved. I didn't want to be the one behind the camera anymore. I wanted to be the one playing with them and making those memories. And that was my goal of losing weight.
Okay, so how have you been training for this half marathon?
Sure. So a lot of my lunch breaks, I fortunately work remotely right now. So my lunch breaks are spent in my neighborhood. I lace up my shoes and I just go out and run. I run about three to four times a week, a couple miles at a time, about 4 to 5 miles. Get the hills in, get ready for those Pittsburgh miles. I've heard they're a challenge, but I just run the neighborhood. And then on the weekends, that's when I do my long runs.
How much of this running this half marathon is maybe proving something to yourself?
It's everything. I've been living by the mantra for these past few years. She believed she could, so she did. I know that I can do this.
So will your daughters be there?
Unfortunately, no. They are 4 and 2. And I don't think keeping them entertained for about 2.5 hours is on tap for my husband. God bless them. But honestly, they were the catalyst to start my story. So even if they're not there physically, I know they're here.
So final question. Once this is over and done with, do you have a next fitness goal?
Oh, goodness. My husband recently asked me that, and I'm not sure what it is. Do I want to keep active? Yes. The thought of triathlons actually came in my head because I enjoy swimming. I'm like, maybe I'll get a bike. So I'm just going to keep expanding my horizons and enjoying what I want to do, keeping fit, keeping healthy, and being a role model for my kids.
Nicole Holderfield is a working mother of 2 daughters from North Huntington, who's running in her first half marathon this Sunday, another step in her journey toward better health. Nicole, thanks so much for coming in, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Kennywood Park is a staple for many Pittsburghers. The amusement park isn't the largest and doesn't have the fastest rides, but visitors return each season for a taste of nostalgia and the classic rickety wooden roller coasters. For our Good Question series, 90.5 WESA's Katie Blackley answers some of the listeners' curiosities about the attractions and history.
On a recent windy morning, crowds gathered around 3 tall blue historical markers. One commemorates Braddock's Crossing, where British troops were defeated during the French and Indian War. The second is for the 121-year-old park itself. And the newest recognizes amusement park entrepreneur Frederick Ingersoll. The 80-acre park has been in this location along the Monongahela River in what's now West Mifflin since 1899. WESA's Good Question series receives a lot of questions about Kennywood's origins. Heinz History Center Director of Publications Brian Butko says it began as a picnic spot called Kenny's Grove on the sprawling land owned by the Kenny family. Then, as its popularity grew, a dance hall was added, and gamblers set up tents on the property.
I guess you could call Kenny's Grove the nuisance bar of the 1890s. It was a pretty wild place.
Kenny's Grove was a cheap getaway for working-class families. Church groups, social clubs, and school children gathered to escape the smoggy steel city.
Between the romance of the early battle and then the industrialization of the steel plant being built there and it being an overlook, I think all that combined to just make it a convenient place for people to gather.
Around the same time, streetcar lines were built throughout the region, linking communities and making it easier for families to travel to different neighborhoods. At the end of these routes, rail companies built small amusement parks with steam engine-powered merry-go-rounds or boats as a way to generate extra revenue for their businesses.
Streetcar railway journals in the 1890s are suddenly filling with not only the technical articles, but how to make money in this new field.
Between 1890 and 1907, there were dozens of these parks. Calhoun Park in Lincoln Place, Oakwood in Crafton, and Dream City in Wilkinsburg. The wealthy Andrew Mellon family saw the financial potential in this arrangement and somewhat controversially formed their own streetcar line, sidestepping the wishes of neighbors who didn't want a route there. The line stretched to Kenny's Grove. Soon, they opened Kennywood, an amusement park with a carousel and a bandstand.
It wasn't about rides so much as music because that whole idea of leisure time was still scandalous.
This was a city filled with hard workers, and the concept of relaxing was foreign to many families. Over the next few years, most of the trolley parks closed. The market was too saturated in western Pennsylvania, and people didn't have that much expendable income. Still, Kennywood survived. Bucko says the families that owned the park in the early 1900s did so for many decades. They were invested in the company and helped keep it modern, all while maintaining a certain level of nostalgia.
How many companies have been around 120 years? Just that in itself is a miracle.
That consistent management, innovation, and a loyal fan base have kept the park going. And a few of those fans wrote into our Good Question series. Ron from Evans City wondered,
at Kennywood, there is a ski lift looking contraption that runs from the parking area down to the park, and I've never seen it operate. So I've always wondered, you know, why it was built and when, if ever, it was used.
This is Kenny's Parkway. It's a people mover ride that Kennywood's Nick Paradise says is used
3 to 10 times a summer, I would say, just based on need.
The ride transports visitors from the top parking lot to the gate on very busy days. From a sprawling picnic spot to a thriving park, Kennywood has evolved over the years. And it still is. A new Steelers football section with the Steel Curtain roller coaster is under construction, and the park was recently named a certified autism center for families with individuals on the spectrum. I'm Katie Blackley, 90.5 WESA News.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. According to the National Crime Information Center, in 2018, there were 610,000 Americans reported missing. More than 70% of those cases involve people under age 21. These cases greatly affect families involved, but also the officers assigned to locate that person. Captain Kobe Webb is one of those officers. She's been in law enforcement in California since 1992 and has handled a number of canine officers through her career. Two of them were on the FBI's call-out list to respond to kidnappings and other high-profile cases. Now she's invented a kit to speed up the process of finding missing children and elderly people. She sat down with the Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski.
So you've developed this kit for people to build what you call a scent profile. What exactly is that, a scent profile?
Well, every person has their own unique smell. And what I wanted to do was be able to provide families a tool where they're able to collect that person's scent and be proactive. So if somebody has dementia, Alzheimer's, autism, anything, because anybody, truly, hikers, hunters, anybody could be lost at any moment. So I wanted them to have something where they are able to hand over that scent to law enforcement as first responders, and they store it in their own home. It's you collect it and store in your freezer. So it's easily accessible to grab for any first responder when we call out the dogs for direction of travel.
So the product is called Find 'Em Scent Safe, and it comes in a little, I would say, 6x6 plastic container. It almost looks like a DVD case. And when you open it up, what's inside?
Well, everything to collect the scent with instructions. And we even tell you where to collect the scent. So if it's a child, we like to put the gauze pad, the sterile gauze pad, in the armpits. And if it's an adult, like an example, an elderly woman underneath the breast, and we tell you to keep that scent there for about 3 to 5 minutes. And then we give you the gloves to be able to use everything without you putting scent on that gauze pad if you're helping somebody to collect the scent. And then you put it in the bag, which is a tamper-proof bag with that adhesive tape that wraps around so that we can tell, because I am a mom, and my kids, when I tell them not to get into something, it's the first thing they get into. So we want to be able to tell if it was tampered, and then you can store it, and it has a zip tie to secure the safe closed.
So what brought you to develop this particular kit? Did something, you know, you have all this experience with different missing persons cases. What about this kit makes the job of law enforcement easier?
Well, the idea came from when I saw the fingerprint kits. And the fingerprint kits are to help identify. And me being a bloodhound handler and a first responder to help locate. The cases where I could not locate somebody are the ones that, what could I have done different? Was it my scent item? And most of the times, the scent item was the issue. Because for me as a mom, I do the laundry. My scent is on everything. I fold it. I put it away. I kiss my kids goodnight, so my scent is on their pillow. And with all that, I really didn't even have anything myself to be able to store and have in a secure place that if one of my kids, if they're on a field trip or anything, I have a kit to be able to hand to somebody right away. So that's where the idea came from, was I wanted to have something to help locate, not identify.
And how does using this kit compare to what law enforcement does now? When a missing person is reported and you show up on the scene, what do they do now to try to build the scent profile without a kit like this?
Right now, it's the handlers entering when they're called and looking for a scent and asking.
And that's the bloodhound handlers.
Well, it's not just bloodhounds. Any breed can trail. My specialty is the bloodhounds, but I have worked other breeds. So it's whenever the search and rescue or law enforcement, any first responders show, and they're going to deploy a dog to give direction of travel. So then we know where to send the helicopter or the people on the foot on the ground to be looking. This here is what will speed up that process to give us direction of travel. So we're almost like leapfrogging. We're ahead of the game before we even look for surveillance footage or anything else. And a dog's nose cannot be replaced. So even with technology, with GPS and everything, we have issues with batteries going dead, programs, software updates, everything. A dog's nose is irreplaceable, and there's dogs all across the United States, and we have mutual aid agreements. So if one small agency or even a large agency doesn't have a resource, we will bring in a resource to deploy, especially when it's anybody missing. That is a priority in all of our day, is to help locate that missing person.
And when you show up on the scene to begin conducting the search for a missing person, what item does a family typically give you, or what items now, other than the kit, are you typically using? And are they effective, and how would the kit be different?
Well, the worst case scenario is missing from a school, because then usually it's like a backpack, and that backpack has been exposed, walking in lines. Everybody's been in it, around it. So that's the absolute worst. When we respond to a residence, a lot of times families will hand us something dirty from the laundry hamper. And that's even a problem sometimes, because do they share the laundry basket? And the last thing we want is a caregiver or a parent handing us the scent item, because now their scent is on it, and we don't want the dog to trail them. Because on most cases, when somebody wanders, people will go look for them themselves. And they're laying a trail, and they're looking for them. And then when they hand us that scent item, we can't tell the dog, no, don't follow the parent or the caregiver, follow just the missing. So right. We really need that one good scent item. So why put anything up against the dog? Have it the best for the dog, so the person's found the fastest, quickest, and brought home right away.
It seems to be a matter of purity. Often when a child or older person goes missing, they'll just grab anything to get the canine officer going. So how important is the purity of scent to the dog?
Well, when you think about, these dogs can trail one person through downtown Pittsburgh. That's how pure that scent item needs to be. Because we have thousands of people walking, crossing, and for that dog to follow that one individual, we want the purest scent item. If we give that dog something with three different scents on it, all we're doing is hindering the animal's ability to be able to locate. So it's very important to us as handlers.
So is the gauze really enough for the canine officer? It's not a very big piece of material.
The sterile gauze pad, it is. We train with that. So for example, we're familiar as handlers, because if it was a criminal missing, for example, if it was a handgun, we don't take the handgun at the start of the trail to go look for somebody. We use a sterile gauze pad, and that's how we collect the scent off the handgun, and then we start trailing. So criminals, you'll see a lot of times we're successful because we preserve it as a crime scene. But that's one scent that doesn't belong. So for example, if it's a knife used in a residence, that person doesn't live there. And then it's controlled. The scene is controlled very quickly. Compared to a missing, everybody's looking, everybody's walking around, and it's not treated instantly with one person's scent. There's multiple people's scent. So we do train with the gauze pads as handlers, so we're familiar with it.
So in a way, this kit sort of puts the resources of police officers into the hands of parents and people with loved ones with Alzheimer's and things like that.
That's exactly what. It was just giving the power to the families to have something to help us, because we're all having the same mission: find the missing person.
This sort of flips the process of a missing person case on its head. It's precautionary. Most families aren't suspecting that one of their loved ones would go missing. So what do you say to those people? Who is this kit for?
It's really for anybody, because even me in law enforcement, I've heard even my friends say that are fellow law enforcement, oh, my kid won't go missing. I watch them like a hawk.
Right.
And I kind of smile, saying, well, you know, sometimes, though, I can't control everything. They do get lost. And not only that, with dementia, I see it with my parents and my dad, and it's once again, it can happen to me. And here I am, even with a bloodhound, I could have the best dog show up, but if I don't have my dad's scent collected, my mom's going to be the one who would probably collect the scent for the law enforcement, and she wouldn't know everything what to do because she'd be panicking that my dad is missing. So it can happen to anybody at any time. And that's why even, like I said, the hikers, hunters, anybody, right. Just stick it underneath your car seat when you park and you go somewhere, because heaven forbid you slip, you fall, and we have a whole mountain range to look for you. That dog can give us that direction and with that good scent item, and we're going to find you faster.
Right. So the kit looks very scientific. You've got latex gloves, a piece of gauze, a bag that would be hard to contaminate, but you're not a scientist. Was there any scientist involved in the development of this product?
I had it tested with a doctor, and we brought in bloodhounds, and they set it up to see the success rate of the dogs using the kit, and we went over the one-year mark, and the dogs were still able to trail successfully locating the person using this method, this kit.
Wow. So where can people find this kit?
It's on our website, which is www.findemscentsafe.com. You can get them right there. They're available. We'll ship them immediately.
And we'll have a link to that on our website at wesa.fm. And how much does the kit cost?
$19.99.
And once you do the scent profile, you said it lasts for a year. Where would you suggest someone store it?
We recommend their freezer, because it's like any product that with the breakdown, because we are talking scent. So if you stick it in the freezer, it's the safest spot. And as you stated, it's like a DVD size case. So it's not large, and you know where it is. You could just grab it and go.
Kobe, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
That's The Confluence's Kylie Kaczynski talking with Kobe Webb. She's a recognized court expert in scent evidence and the inventor of a new product, the Findem Scent Safe. And for today, that's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the local health department says one adult in Allegheny County has contracted measles, and doctors are recommending that anyone who's worried they or their children might have contracted it, stay home and call your doctor before going to an ER or primary care office. A look at what that means for you. If you missed anything from today's program, or you would like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.